It's showtime.
Bob Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go. We are off and running on our buddy Texas T has dubbed a Titanic Moran Tuesday. And I think he's right. This is the fourth day of September 2018. This is the Horn. HeadOn.live is where we live. And, of course, that's where you go if you'd like to be part of the merry, madcap, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is the Horn chat room during the hours in which this program is live. Come on by, go click on chat room, pick out a screen name and a password, jump right in where early arrivers Anatole and VT Blom will eagerly greet you, and you will be moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, although a spacing guild master, has decided to remain Sparky and not fold space. I take it might be a mite hot there in Northern California today in the man cave. It's a mite hot here in the fabulous Horn Studios. Yeah, it's 82 degrees in here. We're going to wring what little bit of summer we've got left out of the season. So naked radio continues here in the Horn Studio. Yeah. We have thanks to send out. Thanks go out to Catherine in California, subscriber. And thanks go out to Paul. Thank you, Paul, for your long support, and Catherine for yours. Thank you very kindly indeed to Thomas. Thank you, Thomas. And thank you to Kelly for your subscription. That's it for the subscribers for this day. And so I can tell you that we had no help overnight from the podcasting crew. So Shirley's Memorial Challenge in memory of Bruce didn't go down. But that leaves us, since we did at least raise $100 last night, that leaves us the $300 to raise this evening. So hopefully that'll happen. You know, 30 new $10 a month subscribers would just be awesome, either at Patreon or at PayPal. That'd be fine. But anyway, you slice it, we got to raise $300 this evening, and hopefully keep the lupine pest away from the porch for a day or two. Yeah, it's a Titanic Moran Tuesday. I was gonna begin the program with a. Actually, a Labor Day story from something that happened Sunday night. Maybe I'll get around to it. By the way, Brother Deacon Asa telling me that we are running hot and true on both the White Rose Society stream and the HeadOn.live stream. That is reassuring. That means that all the various sources where you can sources where you can receive the Horn broadcast in its live manifestation should be up and running, from TuneIn to Roku to Stitcher, etc., etc., etc. So thank you very kindly one and all, for the help last night, and to all of you who keep this program on the air. Remember, this program does not have any advertisers. We're not trying to deliver you to the tender mercies of somebody who wants to sell you some sort of crap. We simply make the program available to anyone who wants it, and hope that goodwill will carry over. I'm told, I don't know if I'm allowed to say who, apparently our little uninterruptible power supply problem that has from time to time resulted in the program going kaput when Appalachian Power, when their rickety, antiquated, poorly maintained, crummy power grid goes south, like when there's a cloud in the sky or something, and sometimes when there's not even that. I am told that that is being replaced, so I'll keep an eye out, looking out for that, and thank you very kindly. And if it's okay to say who to thank, let me know that too. Did I do the "Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid" part? Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It's been a lulu of a day. Between the the generous donor of the UPS will remain anonymous. But thank you. You know who you are. And everybody else thanks you as well. Because not having the program just go kaput because there's a cloud in the sky, because Appalachian Power can't maintain its crappy, antiquated, rickety, falling apart, coal-fried power grid. Well, that's a mighty nice thing to be doing. Thank you very kindly. But it has. It's been a lulu of a day. Primarily, it's been a lulu of a day in the United States Senate. Although the lulu factor was run up to 11 with some releases of excerpts from the new book by Bob Woodward. Now, Bob Woodward is not known for publishing unsubstantiated rumors in things like the National Enquirer. No. He's got a new book out. It is simply being referred to as Fear, F-E-A-R. And it's based upon interviews with various and sundry staffers from the Trump White House. The accounts in the book have already been denounced by Sarah Hasselbeck Sandbags, otherwise known as Aunt Lydia, who lies, it's all lies, it's just lies, right? Yeah, no, because this smacks of truth. And over in the chat room, Sparky posted one excerpt. And it's one of those that makes you, and there's a lot of creepy stuff in there. Maybe we'll go through some of them later. But I got to share this with you at the top of the program. It's very tiny print on the screen, even though the screen is large. So let me move the microphone there. This is an actual excerpt from Bob Woodward's book. For the first 18 months of his presidency, Trump refused to enter the Oval Office alone. You'd think it was in a basement somewhere. The president, whose daily routine begins around 4 a.m., that's with twooping, would sit in a high-backed chair outside and wait until the first staffers trickled in to the West Wing a few hours later. Initially, he would sit in this, it's 4 a.m., And he won't go into his own, he's the president of the United States, he won't go into the Oval Office. And he sits for hours while the other, waiting for the other staffers to come along. Initially, Trump told staffers, quote, he didn't like having to do the work, unquote, of opening the heavy walnut doors leading into the office. But during one closed door meeting in early 2017, with then-Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, he let slip that, quote, the ghosts are here watching, unquote. Now, I have been known for taking some pregnant pauses during this program. Just sort of pulling words together to make sure that I'm getting, saying what I want, what I intend to say. I'm going to read that again, and I'm going to take a pause, and it's not because I don't know what to say. Actually, it is because I don't know what to say. During one closed-door meeting in early 2017 with then-Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, he let slip that, quote, the ghosts are here watching, unquote. That's the pregnant pause I took to let that sink in. Soon after, Trump began telling any staffer who would listen that the ghosts of past presidents were haunting the Oval Office and would frequently, quote, interfere with his work, unquote. According to staff members, when Trump, whom Trump confided in, Lyndon Johnson would torment the president by, and this is again a quote, flicking his ears, unquote, and, quote, hurling important papers onto the floor, unquote. It's worse than we thought. That even sounds kind of ghostly, doesn't it? Yes, it does. Fortunately, I don't believe in ghosties and goblins and spooks and hoodoos and... No. He thinks he's being haunted. It's worse than we thought. I've remarked, and I think maybe our buddy Scott in San Diego joined me in it one evening, talking about, because he's a fan of old films, and we both remarked on the fact that we think that Donald Trump is rapidly approaching his Captain Queeg stage. They thought I was crazy, but I fooled them. I fooled them with the strawberries and clicking a couple of old ball bearings together in his in the palm of his hand, rotating them. I fooled them. It's worse. It's worse than that. He's seeing and hearing things. If how else do you know it's Lyndon Johnson flicking his ears? Why wouldn't that be Abraham Lincoln? Why couldn't it be FDR? Sounds sort of prankish. Sounds like the kind of thing that maybe those wacky Kennedy kids might have done in their younger days. Ear flicking. Maybe it's because of the story of Lyndon Johnson picking up the beagle by its ears. which kind of means that Donald Trump thinks of himself as a big old floppy-eared beagle. Oh, yeah. Yeah, speaking of Scott has an email here. Trump's sitting outside. Wait, does he sit in the anteroom that leads into the Oval Office, or is he just outside the French double doors, sitting on the brick-paved walkway, actually outside the damn building? Any word yet on whether he chats with the portraits of all the dead presidents? Well, that's Nixon. That was Nixon's shtick, so... Really? Ghosts? Ghosts? The ghost of Lyndon Johnson? I'd think the ghost of Lyndon Johnson, knowing the talent that Johnson had for creatively profane invective, would at least be talking. Might call him, you know, dumbass or dipshit or something like that. Ay, ay, ay. He's hallucinating. He's openly hallucinating. Both visually and auditorily. Flavio says, a little early for Halloween on the horn, don't you think? I still prefer the scientific reason, the spirochetes from the tertiary syphilis that he got during his sexual Vietnam. Me too, Flavio. Me too. But remember, from polling data a few years back, more people were certain of the existence of UFOs than were certain that Barack Obama was not the Antichrist. Note coming from Matt, our buddy Matt in San Francisco. Subject line, mental illness. I grew up with a mother who battled bipolar disorder most of her life, finding peace in her last 10 years by finally finding the correct medication. My heart goes out to all who are touched by mental illness. Having said that, I would be happy to volunteer to get to Washington, D.C. and remove 45 and take him to a facility where he can get some help. Got pretty good as a young person at staging the house, so when the police arrived, they would have the evidence needed to at least put a 72-hour hold on a person having an episode. You'll notice I'm not laughing. I mean, I'm not. This is horrifying. He is barking mad. And when Matt says my heart goes out to all who are touched by mental illness, I understand that all too well. I watched a very, very intelligent woman descend into the depths of absolutely incomprehensible dementia. And I don't think anything's ever hurt so much in my life, because I loved her dearly, because she was my grandmother. And she went from having a mind that was like a steel trap to having no mind at all. And we had to hide her shoes from her because she was a proper lady and would not go walk about outside without her shoes on. And so the only way to keep her from taking her walker and heading down the road was to make sure she couldn't find her shoes. She ended her days laying in her bed at night, crying out for Jesus. Ah, darn it. Michael in Madison says, Dig says it's fake. It was too good to be true, wasn't it? That was Michael's estimation. For what it's worth, it seemed a little too good to be true. I'm not finding much else about it. Oh, well. You know what? Even if that part is fake, There's a whole bunch that isn't. And that's plenty terrifying all by itself. I'm just checking out the link here. Dig saying, no, that excerpt about Trump seeing LBJ's ghost is not actually from Bob Woodward's book. Okay, now this is interesting because what's showing up as being fake is the following. When President Trump ordered a first strike on Pyongyang in front of a stunned Joint Chiefs of Staff, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis quickly stood up, grabbed the president's nose, and slipped his thumb between his index and middle fingers. "Mr. President, I have your nose. I'm so sorry, and I don't know how that happened, but I have your nose," Mattis said, as aides scrambled in panic around the West Wing. After several minutes, the situation de-escalated when it was confirmed that Secretary Mattis was not in possession of the president's nose. It was his thumb, Trump announced, and frankly, it didn't look like much like my nose in the first place. In the confusion, the president forgot about his decision to start nuclear war. Then the passage I shared with you about the ghosts. Yeah, it's not real. It was apparently tweeted by rogue White House senior advisor with the comment, "This Bob Woodward book is bananas." But here's the thing. It's still worse than we thought. By a long shot. Stunningly so. The Washington Post excerpted it. Let's see. Among other things, Woodward says that Trump regretted having to denounce the Nazis at Charlottesville. "That was the biggest fucking mistake I've made," Trump told advisors shortly after giving a speech that condemned white nationalists. Woodward's sources also told him Trump called the speech the worst he'd ever given. They tried to do a practice session for what it would be like if Trump sat down with Robert Mueller. It was a miserable failure. At the end of a half an hour rant against his own lawyers, Trump said, "I don't really want to testify." And one of his lawyers, who is apparently maybe not there anymore, said, "Well, it's either that or an orange jumpsuit." Or, hearkening back to the "I've got your nose" funny story, Secretary of Defense James Mattis, noted that Trump has the understanding of a fifth or sixth grader. He figured it out when they were talking about troops on the Korean Peninsula. Or this excerpt in full. With Trump's rage and defiance impossible to contain, cabinet members and other senior officials learned to act discreetly. Woodward describes an alliance among Trump's traditionalists, including Mattis and Gary Cohn, the president's former top economic advisor, to stymie what they considered dangerous acts. "It felt like we were walking along the edge of the cliff perpetually," Porter is quoted as saying. "Other times we would fall over the edge and an action would be taken." After Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad launched a chemical attack on civilians in April 2017, Trump called Mattis and said he wanted to assassinate the dictator.
Let's fucking kill him. Let's go in. Let's kill the fucking lot of them,
Trump said, according to Woodward. And finally, aides hid documents from Donald Trump in hopes that he would not start World War III. At one point, Trump asked Mattis why the U.S. spends so much money trying to detect North Korean missile launches, to which Mattis replied, "We're doing this in order to prevent World War III." Great God in heaven. Like I said, you don't need the ghost story. It's still worse than we thought. And that's just a few of the titbits in the Woodward book, who has a pretty long history of getting things right, going all the way back to, when he and Carl Bernstein were cub reporters on the staff of the Washington Post. Matt in San Francisco says, "Well, even if it is fake, my offer still stands." That's because you're a patriot, Matt. Yes. Meanwhile, Todd down in South Carolina stands, says, subject line, Doonesbury. "For some reason, these scenarios you're describing remind me of Doonesbury cartoons when I was a teen. What do you think?" Oh, well, that's... If they do, that is because that is the level to which Donald J. Trump has descended the presidency. They're just floating. All the gravity is gone. He just floats Harkonnen-like from room to room. And whatever the spirochetes are shrieking about is what happens to come out of his mouth at that time. How do we know these accounts are true? There's no better way than going to the source itself, Donald Trump.
"It's just nasty stuff. I never spoke to him. Maybe I wasn't given messages that he called. I probably would have spoken to him if he'd called, if he'd gotten through. For some reason, I didn't get messages on it. It could just be made up by the author."
And then Sarah Hasselbeck Sandbags chimed in and said,
"This book is nothing more than fabricated stories, many by former disgruntled employees."
Gary Cohn, former disgruntled employee.
"Told to make the president look bad. While it is not always pretty and rare that the press actually covers it, President Trump has broken through the bureaucratic process to deliver unprecedented successes for the American people."
Except for the fact that the successes aren't unprecedented and, well, they're not really successes. And I'm getting really sick of hearing the millionaire pundit class saying, "Well, you know, Fred, the economy is going pretty well these days."
Really?
How do you define the economy is going pretty well when farmers are taking it on the chin? We're in trade wars all around the globe. Oh, we're basing it on Wall Street, aren't we? When Wall Street is no indication at all of how the country is doing, it's just an indication of how our betters are doing. Is that the new definition? America's doing well as long as the rich are doing well? Well, in that case, you know, America was doing freaking great during the Great Recession of 2009, 2010, 2011.
Because the rich were doing great. It was the people getting bounced out of their homes that were having a bit of a tough time of it. Yeah. Subject line, frankly, Matt in San Francisco says, as far as I'm concerned, the entire Republican Party should be dissolved. Let's have another election. Let the chips fall where they may. Nobody in the halls of power seemed to give a shit about the Constitution, so why the hell are we still playing hide the Russian with a White House full of mafioso? This is beyond ridiculous. It's getting to the point where I have to listen to music so I don't drive off the Golden Gate Bridge to my death. Don't do that, Matt. Don't do that. I mean, you're in San Francisco. Go, you know, go somewhere and ponder that massive, exquisite, magnificent example of American can-do determination that we used to have. Mm-hmm. But what Matt says is absolutely true. Oh, and thank yous go out. Thank you very kindly to our buddy Steve in New York, who gets us started this evening. We got $290 to go this evening now, and thank you very kindly, Steve. Look, I mean, we haven't got, so this is a nice segue. This is a nice segue to the business with the Senate today. Oh, wait a second. Clarity with a message. No, Bob, it's an episode of The Simpsons. Lisa goes to D.C. The statues talk to her. That too. For those of you who watched the Senate hearings, and I know many of you did, the opening of the Kavanaugh hearings, well, what you saw was another. Well, first of all, since January 20th, 2017, government has been reduced to reality show in serial format. And what you saw today was another installment this example being the matter of the Senate abandoning all pretense of being a co-equal part of government and abandoning all pretense of patriotism. Because that's exactly what happened. Desperate to do whatever they could to stop the Mueller investigation, Mitch McConnell and Charles Grassley conspired. Just because they conspire doesn't mean it's wrong or that it's criminal. Arguably, it might be by the time everything shakes out. But they conspired together to ram the Kavanaugh nomination through and get him onto the Supreme Court in time to stop the Mueller investigation before it can get all the way to Donald Trump. And we can have some sort of an adjudication of either his sanity, his criminality, or both. It was pathetic to behold. The Republicans were, by God, going to hold this hearing, even though. Something on the order of 90% of the vetting of Judge Kavanaugh has not been done. Mm-hmm. It got off to a pretty
pretty rocky start because the Democrats did at least try to keep this miscarriage of justice from taking place. Let's see here. Now let's check in with the audio. It was supposed to begin at 9:30 a.m.
I welcome everyone to this confirmation hearing on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh.
Mr. Chairman.
To serve as Associate Justice.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be recognized for a question before we proceed. We cannot possibly move forward, Mr. Chairman, with
this hearing. I extend a very warm welcome
to Judge Kavanaugh. We have not been given an opportunity to have a meaningful
hearing on this
nominee.
To his wife, Ashley, their two daughters.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with my colleague,
friends,
Senator Harris.
And you're rightly proud
of the judge.
Mr.
Chairman, if we cannot be recognized, I move to adjourn. We have been denied real access to the documents we need to advise.
Mr. Chairman, regular order is called for.
Which turns this hearing into a charade and a mockery of our norms.
Sir, this committee is a violation of the values that we as a committee have striven for, transparency. We are rushing through this process in a way that is unnecessary.
That is why? Unprecedented. That is not regular order.
I do not understand why that is not a legitimate point of order at this point, because at the end of this hearing, it is too late to consider it.
What are we trying to hide? Why are we rushing?
We should not be proceeding until we have a response and these documents have been available.
We should not be proceeding until we have the full documents that allow us to review the judge's records.
We waited for more than a year with a vacancy on the Supreme Court under the direction of your leader in the United States Senate, and the Republic survived. The fact that we cannot take a few days or weeks to have a complete review of Judge Kavanaugh's record is unfair to the American people.
Just on the basic ideals of fairness, the traditions of this body, we should have a thorough understanding of the nominee that's put before us so that we can vet them.
I've been in the Senate for 19 Supreme Court nominations. What is being done here is unprecedented. And I keep coming back to the same question I ask. What are we trying to hide? What are we hiding? What's being hidden? Why not have it open like all others? Only other.
And thanks to Think Progress for that montage. That's how it got started. It didn't get any better. And Chuck Grassley, well, Chuck got a little testy.
Good morning. I welcome.
This is without the music.
Welcome everyone to this confirmation hearing on the nomination of
Mr.
Judge
Chairman.
Brett Kavanaugh.
Mr. Chairman.
To serve as Associate Justice.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be recognized for a question before we proceed.
Regular order, Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be recognized to ask a question before we proceed. The committee received just last night, less than 15 hours ago, 42,000 pages of documents that we have not had an opportunity to review or read or analyze.
You're out of order. I'll proceed.
We cannot possibly move forward, Mr. Chairman.
I extend a very warm welcome to Judge Kavanaugh.
We have not been given an opportunity to have a meaningful hearing
Ashley,
on the nominee.
Their two daughters.
Now, that was a little bit of strategery right there. Leaving it to a female to open the challenge because, well, how very typical. The woman talks, the Republicans ignore her. And it went on and on and on that way. Senator after senator after senator. And after a while, the folks over in the Trump regime started counting the interruptions. Blumenthal, 13. Booker, 10. Harris, 8. Hirono, 6. Klobuchar, 3. Whitehouse, 2. Leahy, 1. Coons, 1. Total, 44. Oh, look! Sarah Hasselbeck's sandbags can count to 44. One wonders how she managed to count all the way to 13. Maybe those size 13 pumps had to come off and she started working with her toes. But the fact of the matter is, this is a farce. And it is a farce based upon, driven by abject desperation. And Chuck Grassley, like I said, he got peeved. Bless his little heart.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Can I ask my colleagues on the other side of the aisle how long you want to go on with this? Because I'm not going to entertain any of the motions you're making. We're not in an executive session. And I think we ought to level with the American people. Do you want this to...
Yeah, let's do level with the American people, Chuck. You un-American old crank. You're going to ramrod Brett Kavanaugh through because, well, look, let's just be plain about this. I keep talking and trying to explain that some of these things have absolutely nothing to do with Donald Trump. And Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, while it inures to Trump's benefit, well, he's a Republican wet dream. He's going to go up there. He's going to gut labor law. He's going to vote to gut environmental law and regulations. He's going to vote to take his small government conservatism right up the hoo-hoos of every woman in the United States. And they've been aching to do this for eons. Brett Kavanaugh is weirder. For those of us of a certain age, he makes Robert Bork, Brett Kavanaugh does. He makes Robert Bork look like FDR. That is how much of a wild-eyed ideologue he is. And so there's a yearning on the part of the Republicans on that panel to get Kavanaugh to a floor vote and on to the Supreme Court. Never mind the year. We've got to have a ninth justice. Didn't need one back when. Well, that's because, you know, we didn't need a ninth justice because there was a Kenyan Muslim usurper in the White House. Sure. Part of it does, however, inure to the benefit of the chlamydia Claudius. Because, of course, Kavanaugh has a track record of saying that the President of the United States is above the law. That's what it boils down to. You'll hear a lot of flowery language, but it boils down to Brett Kavanaugh thinks the President of the United States does not have to obey the laws of the United States. Never mind that presidential oath business about protecting and defending the Constitution and faithfully executing the laws. Brett Kavanaugh says that he can break them at will and cannot, and if he should happen to break them, cannot be disturbed having broken them. A little more of Grassley's conniption.
Go on all day because I have been patient. I've been accused of having a mob rule session. Now, if we have a mob rule session, it's because the chairman's not running the committee properly.
Well, here's the problem. You heard all those Democrats from that one montage. Not one of them accused Chucky of having mob rule. That was what the second in command of the Republican caucus in the Senate said, namely John Cornyn. He used the phrase mob rule. But, you know, Chuck's getting up in years and it right.
But since every one of you on that side of the aisle, except Senator Booker, Senator Harris, new to the committee, said during Justice Gorsuch's hearing, every one of you prefaced your comments on how fair was in running that hearing. Now, this is the same Chuck Grassley that ran the Gorsuch hearings. I'd like to run this hearing the same way if you'll give me the courtesy of doing it.
Well, but see, Chuck, that was before we knew for a goddamn fact that the President of the United States, who appointed Ann's boy Neil, nominated Ann's boy Neil, was an unindicted co-conspirator on, as the millionaire pundits say, two crimes, but actually he's an unindicted co-conspirator probably on more like four, if you count the substantive crime and the conspiracy to commit alongside it. And the President of the United States has no business appointing so much as a dog catcher in Washington, D.C. because he is under the cloud of his own alleged felonious conduct. This isn't rocket science. It's politics. And if the shoe were on the other foot, the Republicans would have no problem whatsoever recognizing it. I mean, after all, They made up a precedent that didn't exist. Well, you know, he's almost out of office now. It's 14 months before he leaves office. And we think the Negro has just appointed quite enough Supreme Court justices. So no hearing for Merrick Garland. The blackness rubbed off on Merrick Garland. Sorry. It's just too darn bad. Patrick Leahy got pretty disgusted during his opening statement. He gave a pretty quick précis of why Brett Kavanaugh should not have been there.
Reason. Your expansive view of executive power and executive immunity. You've taken the unorthodox position that presidents should not be burdened with a criminal or civil investigation while in office. This is for now we have a president who has declared in the last 24 hours that the Department of Justice shouldn't prosecute Republicans.
You know, it's, that really happened.
It's Alice in Wonderland. And I find it difficult to imagine that your views on this subject escape the attention of President Trump, who seems increasingly fixated on his own ballooning legal jeopardy. When questioning you about these concerns, we'll certainly look to your record on the bench. All of us, Republicans and Democrats, agree that we should. Indeed, your 12 years on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals will loom large during these hearings. But the unknown looms even larger. Before sitting on the bench, you were a political operative involved in the most political and partisan controversies of our time. During this time, you shared your personal view on contentious issues without regard to restrictions imposed by precedent or stare decisis. And it's precisely those views that are being hidden from us today. The Judiciary Committee's Supreme Court hearings are meant to be an unsparing examination of a nominee to a lifetime appointment to our highest court. They are intended to give the American people all the American people a genuine opportunity to scrutinize a nominee's judicial philosophy, beliefs, and character. Because if confirmed with a stroke of a pen, a nominee may impact their lives for a generation or more. And how far have we fallen? Judge Kavanaugh, there are so many things wrong with this committee's vetting of your record. It's hard to know where to begin. I've been on this committee under both Republican and Democratic leadership. I never thought the committee would sink to this. In fact, you shouldn't be sitting in front of us today. You should be sitting in front of us only after we've completed a review of your record. Your vetting is less than 10% complete.
Imagine that. The guy's going to get onto the Supreme Court of the United States with a less than 10% vetting of his entire record. We don't let the most junior recipient of a security clearance in the military have a security clearance on 10% vetting. But that's what the Republicans are up to here.
In critical ways, our committee is abandoning its tradition of exhaustively vetting Supreme Court nominees. First, inexplicably, my Republican friends refused to request records from your 3 years as White House staff secretary, even though you describe those as the most formative for you as a judge, when you provide advice on any issue that may cross the president's desk. Now, we know those issues include abortion, same-sex marriage, and torture. But 6 weeks ago, Senate Republicans huddled in a private meeting with the White House counsel, who's here today. And hours later, the American people were told those records would be off limits. And second, a stark departure from committee precedent, certainly the committee precedent I've seen for 44 years, Chairman Grassley sent a partisan record to request to the National Archives. Not only did it omit all 1 million records from your 3 years as staff secretary, it did not even request a privileged log. That means this committee is in the dark as to what specific documents are being withheld and why. We don't even know what is being hidden. Such a move is simply incompatible with transparency. And third, the archives told us they could not even produce this partial.
Yeah. So that Pat Leahy did a pretty good job of laying out just exactly what's missing. And what a sham this is. And in fact, that was the phrase that the leadership conference used. Vanita Gupta, who's the president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, said after this pathetic little medicine show was over, today's portion of it, "Today was more of the same sad, shameless sham. Committee Republicans willfully refused to focus on how Kavanaugh would rule as a judge. They failed to address the secretive, partisan, and incomplete record review process, and they failed to acknowledge the criminal investigations surrounding the Trump administration. We are screening for a Supreme Court justice, not a PTA president. The next Supreme Court justice will have a lasting impact on our civil and human rights, from health care and reproductive freedom to voting and disability rights. We applaud those senators who sought to postpone the hearing so the Senate and the American people would have access to Kavanaugh's full record as a political operative in the White House. They heard the calls from people demanding transparency and accountability, and they heard from those concerned about this nomination, given all that it is at stake for their lives and freedoms. In the audience during today's hearing were cancer survivors, tribal leaders, families of victims of gun violence, and people with pre-existing conditions who are concerned about their health care. Outside the hearing room in Washington, D.C. and across the land, communities are rising up to demand that this nomination be halted. Senators should listen to them. But Republicans are deaf to them because they don't have enough money to make Republicans discover the ability to hear them. In one instance, the father of one of the girls murdered at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School tried to shake Brett Kavanaugh's hand. Brett Kavanaugh turned his back on him and walked away. Fred Gutenberg tweeted, "Just walked up to Judge Kavanaugh as morning session ended. Put out my hand to introduce myself as Jamie Gutenberg's dad. He pulled his hand back, turned his back to me, and walked away. I guess he did not want to deal with the reality of gun violence." Well, this lit a little bit of a fire under the nether regions of Raj Shah. Raj Shah. Who then responded, "As Judge Kavanaugh left for his lunch break, an unidentified individual approached him. Before the judge was able to shake his hand, security had intervened." Fred Gutenberg wasn't having any of it. He said, "Incorrect. I was here all day and introduced by Senator Feinstein. No security involved." He turned and walked away. Which is basically what he will do on the Supreme Court bench. He will turn his back on the victims of gun violence. He will turn his back on women and their reproductive rights. He will turn his back on the entire body of the criminal law of this country and state that contrary to the to everything we have held to be true since this country's creation, that in fact the President of the United States is above the law and need not even obey it, even though he swears to uphold it and faithfully execute it. He will, in short, make a mockery of American jurisprudence. That's what we're dealing with here. Fred Gutenberg was nothing but polite. Kavanaugh, like any Republican to any victim of gun violence, had nothing but disdain. I mean, I'm sure Kavanaugh's already sent out his thoughts and prayers, so his obligation is over, right? Note coming in from Lee in New York. The Republicans know that facts and details will slow down the process of confirmation. Confirmation is the only aspect that matters to Republicans. The goal is filling a seat. Objections equal obstruction to the Republicans. The Republican view of the future? 4 months until loss of control of legislature, 4 decades of judicial control when confirmation finishes. This is why that last part, 4 decades of judicial control when confirmation finishes. I mean, if you look at Brett Kavanaugh, he looks like he might actually be able to join the full Boy Scouts maybe this year. He's that young. And he looks like a kid. And I think it's time we... Gosh, this is going to seem kind of radical, maybe. I don't know. I think it's time maybe we begin to ponder some possibilities. And by the way, Hung Like Jesus says, "Cold Civil War, Bob?" Exactly. Well, I invented that concept. Or at least I described it. The actual thing I just observed. But here's something I think we need to begin, and it would be nice to hear one of these senators say it out loud. If we can get power back, we absolutely need to put on the table the impeachment and removal from office of Ann's boy, Neil, and if he makes it to the court, Brett Kavanaugh, because they are fruit of the poisonous tree. They are nominees by a president so steeped and so mired in absolute, utter filth and corruption that anything he touches is suspect. He is not a real president. He never has been. He is a product of a manufactured election. And we need to start thinking about how we go about destroying, taking apart, stone by stone, the corrupt effects that he has had on the office. Ron in Raleigh with a note, all over the country. There's an ongoing effort all over the country to grab and maintain as much power as they can. Even if they lose elected seats, the judiciary from the state level on up to the federal level will remain in the hands of the Republican Party for as long as I can see. Here in North Carolina, Trump has put forth a 36-year-old woman who has only practiced law since 2011 to sit on the Fourth Circuit. This is the seat that the Republicans wouldn't allow Barack Obama to seat a judge. This is a lifetime appointment. If she sits on the court for 30 years, she won't be as old as I am now. The judiciary in Republican hands would be able to circumvent any laws and rules put forth by a Democratic president and legislature for as long as they like. And this is just Trump's first term. That is certainly sobering, Ron. Jeff from Hellhole, Indiana, with a note. Bob, my youngest niece is a fourth grader, and she is more aware of world affairs and how shit works than Trump is. So saying he understands at a fifth or sixth grade level is generous. By the way, she knows without a doubt Trump is a blithering idiot. God almighty. But it wasn't all drama such as that. You remember Ben Sasse? Sasse Ben from Nebraska? Who's a different kind of Republican. Yes. I mean, he's young and good looking. He's a young and good looking white guy. And he doesn't look all freakish like Tom Cotton from Arkansas. And sometimes he says, gosh darn it, our Nebraska values want us to have Nebraska values. Like Merca. Well, he showed his true colors today as well. Oh, yeah. He got real upset. He got seriously butt hurt by the fact that the Democrats didn't want to go forward in a sham hearing straight out of the Banana Republic playbook. All right, gotta let the goddamn ad play. I thought I had it queued up, but sometimes I make a mistake that way. But he didn't like the fact that people were trying to stop the hearing, and so he decided to try to stick his nose right up Brett Kavanaugh's fundament.
Congratulations, Judge, on your nomination, Ashley. Congratulations and condolences. This process has to stink. I'm glad your daughters could get out of the room, and I hope they still get the free day from school. Let's do some good news, bad news.
See, he's a different kind of Republican.
First, Judge, since your nomination in July, You've been accused of hating women, hating children, hating clean air, wanting dirty water. You've been declared a quote-unquote existential threat to our nation. Alumni of Yale Law School, incensed that faculty members at your alma mater praised your selection, wrote a public letter to the school saying, quote, people will die if Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed.
You know, which is true. Which is absolutely true. Because things like environmental regulations that reduce the risk of death, well, those deaths come back when the regulations are struck down. Let's take, just as a for instance, because I just happen to have it handy here. A story from the Associated Press. Trump's rollback of pollution rules to hit coal country hard. The dateline on the story is Granttown, West Virginia. I know where it is. And this is another one of those embarrassing for-profit media stories that's all about how much people love Donald Trump in West Virginia. I guess there's no percentage in highlighting the significant number of people in this state who wouldn't pee in his goddamn mouth if his goddamn guts were on fire. The story, dated sometime yesterday, notes that it's coal people like miner Steve Knotts, 62, who make West Virginia Trump country. Cue the banjo. So it was no surprise that President Donald Trump picked the state to announce his plan rolling back Obama-era pollution controls on coal-fired power plants. Trump left one thing out of his remarks, though. Northern West Virginia coal country will be ground zero for increased deaths and illnesses from the rollback on regulation of harmful emission from the nation's coal power plants. An analysis done by his own Environmental Protection Agency concludes that the plan would lead to a greater number of people here dying prematurely and suffering health problems that they otherwise would not have than elsewhere in the country when compared to health impacts of the Obama plan. Knotts, a coal miner for 35 years, isn't fazed when he hears that warning a couple of days after Trump's West Virginia rally. He says the last thing people in coal country want is the government slapping down more controls on coal.
People here have had it with other people telling us what we need. We know what we need. We need a job. We don't need no air. We don't give a fuck about breathing. We just want a job.
Okay, I added that last part. We need a job, Knotts said at a lunch hour at a Circle K in a tiny town between two coal mines and 9 miles down the road from a coal power plant, the Granttown plant. But old Steve there's probably going to die early. Because he just needs a job. He don't need no clean air.
Fuck a bunch of clean water.
Trump's rollback would kill an extra 1.4 to 2.4 people a year for every 100,000 people in those hardest hit areas, compared to under the Obama plan, according to the EPA analysis. For 1.8 million West Virginians, that's about two dozen extra deaths a year. Let's remember that we do about 1,000 excess deaths per year in West Virginia's mountaintop removal counties already. Also from breathing filth in the air. And then they quote experts who aren't anywhere near West Virginia talking about what these things will do, what these rollbacks and these assaults on health-based regulations will wind up doing.
Actually, they did manage to quote Vivian Stockman. I know Viv from the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. So they found somebody that disagrees with Trump. Meanwhile, retired coal miner Jim Haley, living 4 miles from the town's coal-fired power plant, has trouble telling from the smokestack when the plant is even operating. They got steam coming out of the chimneys. That's all they got coming out of it. Only that's not true. Because there are particulates. And the particulates will go up, and that means the deaths will go up. But Ben Sasse, a new kind of Republican from Nebraska, says, that's just silly. It's ridiculous to say that Brett Kavanaugh's decisional history will have a will cause anybody to die. I mean, that's just ridiculous. Right? Except it's true. And Ben Sasse from Nebraska, a new kind of Republican, doesn't give a flying fuck.
This drivel is patently absurd. And I worry that we're going to hear more of it over the next few days.
He's worried. Ben Sasse, a new kind of Republican, is sounding an awful lot like the plain old garden variety, same old Republican that hates those job-killing regulations. And for all that he disagrees with Donald Trump, he, too, is trying to cram his head right up Donald Trump's ass so that you can see the smiling face of Ben Sasse, a new and different kind of Republican, when Donald Trump yawns. It's absurd to care about when people die that don't need to die because of the judicial decisions of people like Brett Kavanaugh. It's absurd. It's patently absurd, and it's drivel to talk about it when those, well, those meaningless poors die off. Don't worry, there'll always be more poors, says Ben Sasse, a new and different kind of Republican.
But the good news is, it is absurd, and the American people don't believe any of it. This stuff isn't about Brett Kavanaugh when screamers...
Well, thank you. Blowjob?
...say this stuff for cable TV news. The people who know you better, not those who are trying to get on TV, they tell a completely different story about who Brett Kavanaugh is. You've earned high praise from the many lawyers, both right and left, who've appeared before you during your 12 years on the D.C. Circuit, and those who've had you as a professor at Yale Law and at Harvard Law.
He never flicked a booger at me, not once.
Invariably applaud your mind, your work, your temperament, your collegiality. That's who Brett Kavanaugh is. And to quote Lisa Blatt, a Supreme Court attorney from the left who's known you for a decade, quote, sometimes a superstar is just a superstar, and that's the case with this judge. The Senate should confirm him. Close.
Anybody want to look up Lisa Blatt and find out what version her leftism takes? An attorney from the left? I'm guessing she's off a number of Christmas card lists at this point, maybe of people who advocate for a woman's right to decide how her reproductive organs are going to work and when they're going to work. I'm guessing Lisa Blatt, well, no, right.
It's pretty obvious to most people going about their work today that the deranged comments actually don't have anything to do with you. So,
deranged, deranged. I'm pretty sure the vast majority of the Horn Family Community Congregation are in quite good control of their faculties. I know I am. I don't feel the least little bit deranged. Pointing out how hostile this man is to a woman's right to choose, pointing out how hostile he is to any idea of taking people's health seriously and putting it before the needs of corporate shareholders in polluting extraction industries.
I don't think it's at all deranged to wonder where the $200,000 came from that suddenly paid off his baseball ticket habit. There's nothing deranged in wondering what kind of opinions he rendered when the questions were bouncing around the dim leader Oval Office during the reign of error, and the questions were brought up about who we should torture and how often and how. Because, you know, if asking those questions is deranged, then Ben Sasse, a new and different kind of Republican's idea of sanity, is, to say the least, suspect. And to say more, perhaps sociopathic.
Oh. We should figure out, why do we talk like this about Supreme Court nominations now? There's a bunch that's atypical in the last 19 months in America.
Senator, he uses words like atypical. Yeah, that's a good point. Cowbell for clarity. Out of range, but not deranged as of yet. And see, that's the nice thing about a Brett Kavanaugh or a Ben Sasse, a new and different kind of Republican. They're out of range, too. Neither one of these paragons of Republican pro-business philosophy are ever going to get anywhere near a holler where the micro-fine particulates float in the air and you can't even see them, but you breathe them in anyway, and once they get into your body, they go about the hellish business of turning your life into cancer. Ben Sasse's never going to do that. Brett Kavanaugh probably couldn't find West Virginia with a fucking map and a hillbilly to hold it for. NIMBY.
Klobuchar's right. The comments from the White House yesterday about trying to politicize the Department of Justice, they were wrong, and they should be condemned. And my guess is Brett Kavanaugh would condemn them.
Well, thank you for speaking for Brett Kavanaugh, because my guess is he wouldn't. My guess is he shares the views of Donald Trump. Because how far is a man going to go? If you already believe that the president's above the law, maybe the president's party's above the law, too. Maybe everybody that you like is above the law. James in Illinois says, now that don't make no sense. What's 2.4 persons? Two adults and an 8-year-old? 4 tenths, 7 to 72, 4 and 7, 1 and 32, 4 and 30, 18. 72, 7.2. No, that's a 30-year-old, James. That's two 50-year-olds and a 30-year-old. If you go with 4 tenths of the allotted biblical 70, 70, not 72, but you get the idea. Mm-hmm.
Really, the reason these hearings don't work is not because of Donald Trump. It's not because of anything the last 20 months. These confirmation hearings haven't worked for 31 years in America. People are going to pretend that Americans have no historical memory, and supposedly there haven't been screaming protesters saying women are going to die at every hearing for decades. But this has been happening since...
No. See, there weren't any women are going to die protesters at Sonia Sotomayor's confirmation, or at Ruth Bader Ginsburg's, or at Elena Kagan's. Stephen Breyer's. Because they could be relied upon to respect a woman's constitutional right.
to the determination of the workings of her own reproductive system. So no, Ben Sasse, you new and different kind of Republican, but still a liar. They haven't always done that. They've only done that when justices hostile to a woman's right to choose have been sitting in the chair where Brett Kavanaugh will be seated for the next few days. Because they are hostile. There's no getting around the fact that Clarence Slappy Pubes on the Coke Can Thomas is hostile to a woman's right to choose. There's no doubt that Sammy Bad Breath Alito is hostile to a woman's right to choose. There is no doubt that John Roberts is hostile to a woman's right to choose. There's no doubt that Ann's boy Neil Gorsuch is hostile to a woman's right to choose. They have already proven it. They have a background. They have writings. They have opinions. And they have public statements. And so too does Brett Kavanaugh. Remember, this is the Brett Kavanaugh who wanted to force a little immigrant girl to have a baby that she was not ready to have and did not wish to have. So for all the talk about what a new and different kind of Republican Ben Sasse is, he sounds like the same old bullshit to me. To see if you agree.
It's Robert Bork. This is a 31-year tradition. There's nothing really new the last 18 months. So the fact that the hysteria has nothing to do with you means that we should ask, what's the hysteria coming from? The hysteria around Supreme Court confirmation hearings is coming from the fact that we have a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of the Supreme Court in American life now.
Oh, well, thank you fucking Socrates for explaining that to me. Scott in San Diego says, Ben Sasse, a new kind of Republican? What, he pees sitting down? No, not hardly. It's just that he's not old and cranky yet. He's all young and handsome, and he doesn't talk with a wheat stem sticking out of his mouth or something. Ron and Raleigh. Dead people, you say? Unless you pile those excess bodies like cordwood on the porch of these Republican sumbitches, they just don't exist. And just exactly what does new kind of Republican mean? Although his delivery is smoother, he sounds just as nasty as the rest. And that, Ron, is the entire point. Oh, okay, I understand. James said, come on, Bob, I was going by the pound. Well, if it's by the pound, then yeah, it's probably two adults and an 8-year-old. Yeah, back to Ben Sasse.
Our political commentary talks about the Supreme Court like there are people wearing red and blue jerseys. That's a really dangerous thing. And by the way, if they have red and blue jerseys, I would welcome my colleagues to introduce the legislation that ends lifetime tenure for the judiciary. Because if they're just politicians, then the people should have power and they shouldn't have lifetime appointments. So until you introduce that legislation, I don't believe you really want the Supreme Court to be a politicized body.
That sounds like a little bit of a tautology to me, but far be it, I'm just a hillbilly. But the fact of the matter is the Supreme Court is not supposed to be political, but it goddamn sure is. And the appointments have been political. He's complaining about the appointment of Robert Bork. Well, it was the nomination of Robert Bork that began this process of rank and overt politicization of the Supreme Court for partisan purposes and as a matter of partisan reward. Robert Bork had been a good soldier. Robert Bork had been the Solicitor General who fired Archibald Cox in the Saturday Night Massacre after two attorneys general, or an attorney general, whatever, refused to do it and resigned rather than do it. Robert Bork said, well, hell no, I'll do it. You're fired, motherfucker. And Nixon said, good boy, good boy. And so scant years later, 11 or so, 12 maybe, Robert Bork's loyalty to Richard Nixon was rewarded by Ronald Reagan with an appointment to the Supreme Court. So Ben Sasse, that new kind of not very new at all or different Republican, is complaining about a process that was begun by the patron saint of the Republican Party.
Though that's the way we constantly talk about it now. We can and we should do better than this. It's predictable that every confirmation hearing now is going to be overblown, politicized circus.
And you know what else? That's because, as we've seen from Geezer Disgustus's nominations for multiple levels of the federal bench, judicial genius is not rewarded. Political hucksterism is. Have we so soon forgotten the judge that was even rejected by Republicans when he couldn't tell the Judiciary Committee what a goddamn motion in limine is? Or whether he'd ever even been in the courtroom when one was presented? There are brilliant legal minds out there from the right and the left. They seldom get judge jobs. Instead, they toil away in relative obscurity, writing equally obscure tomes on arcane points of law as law school professors. My old constitutional law professor argued the case in the West Virginia Supreme Court recently in favor of Don Blankenship's claim that the West Virginia sore loser law violates the federal constitution and the West Virginia constitution and denies equal protection of the law to third parties that would like to have a candidate on the ballot. The West Virginia Supreme Court rejected his argument, even though he is more knowledgeable about constitutional law than any one of those justices on the court or all of them taken together. With regard to Ben Sasse, the new kind of Republican, Matt in San Francisco, subject line, this guy. So how does this guy justify keeping the appointment open for a year because the president was half black? If the president's 100% black, do we hold it open for the entire term? Yes. Well, no, three-fifths of the term, Matt, three-fifths of the term. But he's forgotten all of that, you see, because his mind was erased as soon as the black guy was out of his White House. That's how that all works. Terrace with a note says, Sasse and friends, Ivy League repig lickens. Their children have never died in mine explosions and never will. While in utero, their mothers didn't breathe ultrafines in the Appalachians. And three, they always buy organic because they know. Damn, that's good, Terrace. That's good.
And it's because we've accepted a new theory about how our three branches of government should work, and in particular how the judiciary should work.
See, he's trying to set up his bona fides as a real thinking Republican that might qualify him to run in, say, 2024. Or maybe 2020, depending on how things shake out. Ben Sasse has him some ambitions. And he ties a pretty damn nice knot in his necktie, too.
What Supreme Court confirmation hearings should be about is an opportunity to go back and do Schoolhouse Rock civics for our kids. We should be talking about how a bill becomes a law and what the job of Article 2 is and what the job of Article 3 is.
Well, if that's all a Supreme Court nominee's confirmation hearing is, then just play I'm only a bill for your kids and have done and send whatever goddamn goose-stepping fascist you want to up onto the court, Ben Sasse. You'll become more familiar with this jackass as time goes on. Because he has ambitions, and he talks like this. He's always he's about a bubble off of full sarcastic, and he talks as though he knows ever so much more than any of the rest of us stupid proles do. That is not what a Supreme Court confirmation hearing is supposed to be about. There's nothing about confirmation hearings in the Constitution itself. Like so much, it has developed over time as a function of practice and not of mandate. Maybe in its earliest form, the nominee just sort of wandered into the committee room and sat down and had coffee and donuts, and they decided whether or not they liked each other, and he didn't pick his nose while we were having tea, so I guess he can be on the court. But now this stylized process that Ben Sasse is complaining about, well, it is a sham. It has become a stylized form of ritual theater. Because ultimately, in almost every case, the nominee will be determined by whoever holds the majority in the committee. The nominee's fate will be. Republicans through, and Democrats let Democrats through. And occasionally, if an opposition party president sends up a nominee who manages to sit all the way through the hearings without picking his or her teeth with their toenail clippings, the other side will vote for them. But here's what never does happen. At least not since it has become a stylized process. There is no meaningful discussion of the law. None whatsoever. It's all scripted. It's all pontification. And it's all, oh, there's that word again, a sham. And tomorrow, when the questioning begins and somebody finally asks him where he stands on Roe versus Wade, he'll say, well, you know, I really don't want to comment on that because, after all, that's a case that might come before the court, and I don't want to be prejudging any cases. When the fucker prejudged a case years ago, when he started, has prejudged and prejudged and prejudged by doing things like trying to force a little teenage immigrant child to carry a baby to term who didn't want to. You can't get much more prejudgy than that. No, a confirmation hearing, not to sound elitist in my own right or anything, but a confirmation hearing should be kind of a nerdy affair. It should be a discussion of what the Supreme Court is supposed to be, where the nominee sees him or herself fitting in the court. It should be a debate about the issues of the day. Instead of having the nominee hem and haw about not wanting to prejudge anything that he's already prejudged God knows how many times. And I'm going to take this moment, and I hope I'm not going to piss anybody off, but you know who I miss on this committee?
You know who I would like to see just flay the skin off of a miserable hypocrite like Brett Kavanaugh? Al Franken. Oddly enough, he did a better cross-examination than any other Democratic member of the Judiciary Committee. And what was odd about that is he's a non-lawyer. And that meant that he studied and read and learned the stuff that was the stuff that was expected of him so that he could do his best by the people of Minnesota. Too bad, huh?
So let's try just a little bit. How did we get here and how can we fix it? I want to make just four brief points. Number one, in our system, the legislative branch is supposed to be the center of our politics. Number two, it's not. Why not? Because for the last century, and increasing by the decade right now, more and more legislative authority is delegated to the executive branch every year. Both parties do it. The legislature is impotent, the legislature is weak, and most people here want their jobs more than they really want to do legislative work, and so they punt most of the work to the next branch. Third consequence is that this transfer of power means the people yearn for a place where politics can actually be done. And when we don't do a lot of big, actual political debating here, we transfer it to the Supreme Court. And that's why the Supreme Court is increasingly a substitute political battleground.
That's supposed to make him sound like a really new and different, smart kind of Republican. When in fact it's just the same old stuff, repurposed with a nice flat Midwestern accent, instead of some Southern senator crowing about states' rights. James in Illinois asking, subject line Constitution, doesn't it say advice and consent? It does say advice and consent. That does not include the concept of hearings. Hearings are what evolved out of the idea of advice and consent. Interestingly, part of that advice and consent is the Senate actually doing it. There was a compelling argument when they decided, when Mitch McConnell decided to declare that Barack Obama was only three-fifths of a president and would not even meet with Merrick Garland. There was a compelling argument to be made that Merrick Garland could say, okay, you had your chance to advise and consent. Your silence is your acceptance. So I'm going to go take my seat now. Fuck y'all. And more, I think he probably should have done that. Because what we're getting at here is a desire to avoid real and meaningful confrontation. The Constitution, some people, and maybe it happens on both sides of the aisle, tiptoe around it as though it were some little virgin the night before his or her wedding that they don't want to have a dirty joke. And the dirty joke is, of course, the messiness of participatory government. But we can't have that. Behind this slick facade of my dear friend and my bosom buddy, the senator from Dumbfuckistan, resides a recognition that they are not doing the business of the Constitution the way the Constitution was written. That part of the new kind of Republicans' argument has a little bit of validity. But for him to complain that the executive branch is getting too much administrative power because the Congress doesn't want to run things. Here, let me just try this one on for size. Try to imagine this Republican Congress administering the Social Security Administration.
Try to imagine this Congress, or practically any other, running Medicare. Or the Federal Aviation Administration. Or the Food and Drug Administration. Those are supposed to be administrative agencies that administer laws because they have the expertise with which to administer the laws. And in providing the enabling legislation for such administration, there is a recognition that the legislative body are largely generalists and not specialists. But I guess Ben Sasse would like to run the Social Security Administration right into the ground, you know, because he's a new and different kind of Republican, you understand.
In America. It is not healthy, but it is what happens, and it's something that our founders wouldn't be able to make any sense of. And fourth and finally, we badly need to restore the proper duties and the balance of power from our constitutional system. So point one, the legislative branch is supposed to be the locus of our politics, properly understood. Since we're here in this room today, because this is a Supreme Court confirmation hearing, we're tempted to start with Article 3. But really, we need Article 3 as the part of the Constitution that sets up the judiciary. We really should be starting with Article 1, which is us. What is the legislature's job? The Constitution's drafters began...
You just know that most of the people in the Senate probably hate his goddamn guts and want to give him a swirly and a wedgie and stuff him in a locker. This guy hasn't been a senator... As long as I've been hosting this program. But by God, he's going to lecture the Senate on what it needs to be. That's bound to go over like a turd in a punch bowl with, say, a Patrick Leahy with his 44 years of experience. Isn't he sickening, Ben Sasse? Ron in Raleigh says, it occurs to me, old Ben seems to be on the opposite side of a Venn diagram from Donald Trump. He's just as mean and nasty as Trump. He just puts a happy face on it. He does believe he's smarter than anybody else. I'd love to see him in a meeting with Trump. P.S. Al should run again. Anybody. But, yeah. Al should have been president. Al won the election. But there's a kernel well worth paying attention to in what Ron says. Because I've warned in the past that one of these days we're going to get a Republican who runs for president who's actually sharp enough to do the things that get Republicans all damp in their maiden forms, like killing Social Security and destroying Medicare. Ben Sasse's that guy. Never let a Ben Sasse anywhere near the reins of power. Because... He'll make it work. He'll make the things that Donald Trump wants to do happen with brutal and unflinching efficiency. It's about a quarter before the third hour of the program. I need to send out thanks to Charlene in Rhode Island. Thank you, Charlene, so very much. That means we've got $250 to go this evening of the $300 we needed to raise. Thank you so very much, Charlene, and thank you very kindly to Steve in New York. I'm sure they'd love to have some company as we try to make our way down toward staying out of a great big whopping terrifying hole for this beginning of the last few weeks of summer. Let's see here. I'm about sick of Ben Sasse. How about you?
Let's go and check in for a minute or two with Scott in San Diego. Hey, Scott.
No, wait a minute. Just hold on. I've gotten back a minute. When have I ever done a call with a minute or two, Bob? Come on.
Well, now, I mean...
You threw off my game plan. I was picking up a cup of my cheap coffee because I figured you would have a few more.
I'm gonna take up a collection to buy you a French press or something.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm worried about you drinking all that freeze dried. Not good for your insides or something. I think.
Really? Because I used to. You know what I would like to find? I don't even know if they still make them. But when I was growing up, my mom and dad used to make their Louisiana coffee on an old-fashioned percolator.
Oh, yes.
Do they still even make those things?
Oh, yeah, you can get them.
Because there was something about percolated coffee that was distinct from, like the Mr. Coffee-type machine.
Yeah, well, that's because it gets cooked.
Well, maybe that's it.
The coffee gets cooked.
It didn't kill it. In other words, it seemed more full-bodied than those even the bun coffee maker, which I had. The old Paul Harvey sold me on his radio show.
Yeah, see, I tried the bun, and I didn't like it because of the design. That round basket there, the coffee just tends to... go through. If you're gonna do the drip method, I prefer the ones with the cone shaped filter.
Like Melita.
Right, because it tends to stay on the grounds a little bit longer.
Yeah. Wow.
But I've become a devotee of French press coffee ever since I brought my decaf with chicory home with me from New Orleans.
Now that's got the plunger mechanism.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah, you can get, and the neat thing is, because I'm, you know, sort of detail-oriented sometimes and a little bit obsessive-compulsive,
yeah,
you can get real asshole-ish with it, because, you get the water not all the way to boiling, but to almost boiling, like, say, 200 degrees, and you pour it over your grounds to about halfway up the French press, and you give it a good stir, then you pour it the rest of the way up, you put the lid on, you don't plunge, and you wait for about 5 minutes or so, and then you very slowly plunge.
Mm.
And
you can
get some pretty good coffee out of it. You'll get a little bit of sludge at the bottom, but if you swirl that last good swallow, you don't notice the sludge.
Yeah, that's almost like science class. I mean, too many steps.
Oh, no, I go full nerd because I... It was in pouring the water that I remembered the word meniscus, and so I make sure that I may, because you know in introductory physical science they taught us how to pour to the level of the meniscus, and you have to pour not to where the edge reaches, but to where the bottom of the meniscus is in order to get a proper measure. So I'm sitting there and I'm pouring and I'm looking. I mean, do you see me ducking my head here like this? Yeah, I'm pouring. I'm looking to make sure that I get it right to the line.
Well, I've concluded...
I hear they have medication for problems like this.
I've concluded, Bob, with your use of the word meniscus, that the brain cells that once held that chunk of information are long gone. But for some reason, I remember the name of my introductory physical science teacher, Mr. Jacques. He wasn't exactly French. I don't know where the hell he was from, but he had a French... name. I think he was from one of the colonies.
You know, for some reason or another, I have managed to forget my teacher's name, but I do recall the fact that she looked a lot like Florence Henderson, and every now and then we would ask her to sing the Wessonality song.
Okay, well, the coffee is all set. I've got to let it sit for a moment to cool down to sipping temperature, which will give me ample opportunity to go over a couple of things with you. One of them was, and I guess my performance will vary from that of the other Horn congregation members, and I don't expect there are any prizes for this, although I would like one of the plush animals from the two top shelves. But what happened this morning, I'm watching day one of the Kavanaugh show. I successfully filled so many Supreme Court nominee opening day GOP talking points bingo cards that my marker ran out of fluid just after 10 a.m.
And you were hoarse from yelling bingo.
Yeah. It was like if I had been playing that form of bingo, the runners would get, they'd get winded running over to verify my numbers, my talking points, because they touched on all of them. And where would I find a transcript of Senator Tillis's segment? I've looked several ways online and I can't find that, either video or printed, because he said something, and I don't even want to try to quote him until I have it right in front of me, wherein he very well may have tipped the proverbial GOP hand when he was singing the praises of Mr. Kavanaugh. And I'll wait until I can find his words in print from a transcript and then send it to you to see if you missed it or heard it, or if you did hear it, if you made of it the same thing I did. It was a verbal tell, if there is such a thing. And I hate to bring it up simply because I can't refer to it specifically, but when I heard it, my little ears perked up, like Lyndon's beagle, Little Beagle Johnson. Everything had to be LBJ, so they needn't remonogram all the executive towels.
Right.
Anyway, I will endeavor to find the transcript, so I can quote it directly to make sure I heard what I thought I heard. Because it was a big tell if he did, in fact, say what I think he said. But anyway, there was one other point about the opening day. You know, and who threw out the first softball? I guess Grassley did.
No, Grassley threw out the first lick ball.
Okay.
Tongue ball.
God. I was.
But then again, all the Republicans, to sort of harken back to the Men in Black film, all of the Republicans today proved themselves to be Balchinians.
Okay, refresh my memory, because I don't.
Yeah, their balls are on their chin.
Okay. I'm not even going to go there. Let's keep this on the high plane today. But needless to say, I was not encouraged as I sat here watching it. I think tomorrow I will go with the NPR audio coverage so I don't have to look at them.
Oh, I don't know. Right, I think you want the video, especially after I mentioned the moment with in which a parent of a slain student tried to shake his hand and he shunned him and turned away.
Now, see, that's the source of the video that I watched was streaming online from NBC News, and when the break was announced, they cut to a slide that said live video will resume shortly. So I didn't get to see the where Kavanaugh refused the four guys.
Well, you can find it online. I mean, it's there for the viewing.
Yeah.
But the other visual that was not to be missed, and this was just plain fucking weird, okay?
Yeah.
Was a woman by the name of Lana Bash. Zena Bash.
Okay. Now, no relation to
Dana? I don't know.
Dana.
Zena Bash and apparently that's maybe her married name or something. I don't know. But she's a White House staffer. But apparently before that, she was an intern to Brett Kavanaugh. And she showed up sitting behind him at one point. And it's going to take a moment to walk through this, so please bear with me.
Yeah, okay.
She held a pose while she was sitting behind him. You've heard me talk about and see, it said, "Oh, that was just a prank. That's not real." Some so-called pranksters over at 4chan created this this hoax. Is the way it's described, in which they allege that to hold one's index finger against one's the point of one's thumb, making a circle, and hold up the other three fingers, stands for white power, WP.
You mean like the OK?
Yeah, only you hold it instead of OT, Mr. like Mr. Buckwheat, where you hold it with the blade of your palm on, you hold it with your palm out, and it reads left to right, WP, white power. Now, this was billed as a prank, and that there's really nothing to it. And yet today, sitting behind him, Zina Bash, for a period of time, and you know you can try it. Everybody can try it at home. Just kind of sit there with your arms crossed across your abdomen, on your lap or whatever, and see if at any point in time, your index finger and your thumb join together, and your three remaining fingers, your middle, your ring, and your little finger, spread out in what would otherwise be a W. See if that happens, because it doesn't.
Well, no, even doing
and
yoga,
so and
relaxing,
so she so
I don't expect
right
to do
so
it.
She sat there doing that sign behind Brett Kavanaugh and was caught on camera doing it. And that's just bizarre, Scott.
No, she was. You say she was a former intern for him?
Yeah, and she is. She is some kind of a staffer inside the White House in the Domestic Policy Council.
I was going to say if she had served her time with Kavanaugh and then moved on to something else and was maybe a little disgruntled or disenchanted.
Well, she's also clerked for Sammy Alito.
Oh, okay. So it's a favorable sign, gang sign that she's giving.
Yeah. Now imagine a Democratic nominee to the Supreme Court with someone sitting behind her giving the sign of the Crips or the Bloods or you know whatever. There would be weeping and wailing and shrieking and screaming and carrying on and the QAnon people would be walking around on their teeth.
Well, you got to figure having been an intern, she would be in a position to know if she was sending a message. He's a good guy. He's one of us, so to speak. You know.
I mean, this is a 35-year-old woman, a 35-year-old woman who's a mother, a 35-year-old woman who's a mother who works in the White House, who formerly clerked for Alito,
yeah,
and is bilingual, and Jewish. And what the fuck?
See, I was really hoping that you would say that she served her time, was disgruntled or disenchanted, and was sending a message to the rest of us saying, watch out for this guy. He looks nice and cuddly and friendly, but he's a son of a bitch, so to speak. But she was preaching to the choir in a sign sort of nonverbal way.
Well, I mean, I don't know what else to make of it. Now, I mean, it's now that symbol is also an old juvenile prank. But that makes no sense either. And then a little bit later, lo and behold, she's gone. For instance, during the time in which Pat Leahy was talking to Kavanaugh, she was sitting there behind him. Flavio adds to our quantum of knowledge on Zina Bash. She's also the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors, ergo Jewish. But then again, being Jewish didn't stop Stephen Miller, who also flashed that sign.
No.
And see, okay, this is going to sound double secret probation paranoid. But it was put out, the Anti-Defamation League picked up on it, and then they said, no, it's just a prank. And the egg was on the Anti-Defamation League's face. And then all of a sudden it starts showing up in photographs, and it doesn't look like a prank anymore. But now a Zina Bash can do it, and they go, oh, no, that's not real, that's a prank. Then why are you doing it, Zina?
Well, I've got a question about the nature of these proceedings, and it's only going to get worse, you know, when the actual question and answer periods happen tomorrow and for the next couple of days, as I understand it. One of the senators, and I wish I had made a note as to which one it was, but one of the senators was quoting from the actual writings or speechifying of Mr. Kavanaugh on the topic of indicting a president or prosecuting a president, okay, and giving his reasoning, even though he exercised the option to engage in that back during the Clinton era when he was on Ken Starr's payroll. Never mind that. He's had a Damascus Road moment, supposedly, in the interim, and now he doesn't think it's at all appropriate. But the verbiage that was quoted from Kavanaugh gave the impression that the process of prosecution or indictment to a sitting president would be so disruptive as to upset, it would rent in twain almost the fabric of America. Nothing would get done if such a thing were to happen. And my knowledge of history is this. We actually had in my lifetime a president whose administration and the players were very closely investigated in the Senate Watergate hearings in the summer of 73, spring and summer. And then in the summer of 74, the House Judiciary Committee actually voted in favor of a number of articles of impeachment. And after the smoking gun secret tape was uncovered and publicized, Nixon, to his credit, resigned. Okay? Now, all throughout that period of the Senate Watergate, the House Judiciary, and Nixon actually resigning, in the wake of that, the country seemed to be the country moved on, okay? And when all of it was going on, the country continued to function. I remember I had a job. And then in my off hours, I would do whatever I would do in my off hours. My life wasn't changed in any dramatic or meaningful way because our system was performing as designed, okay? But if you listen to what Kavanaugh says, why, no. Don't believe your lying eyes. Believe me that indictment or investigation or prosecution of a sitting president would be the worst possible thing because it would do irreparable damage to our system and our country and our people and our psyches. And what is the name of that dynamic that you always talk about when it's okay if the Democrats do it, it's the worst.
Are you talking about it used to be IOKIYAR. It's okay if you're a Republican, but now it's IOKIYAM. It's okay if you're a maggot.
Okay.
Or in specific, IOKIYAT. It's okay if you're Trump.
Yeah. Well, my question then is, given that I've expressed this, you know, sufficiently, and you get what I'm talking about, wouldn't that fall under that double standard kind of heading? You know, how can he speak out against something he himself did, first of all, and how can he use as a reasoning irreparable damage when we, in fact, have experienced, many of us who are old enough, the exact opposite of that?
Well, but let me offer a caveat into your on your general statement that America just moved on after Nixon quit.
All right.
And what I would say is that's true. I mean, there was a World Series that year and a Super Bowl the following January and all the things. And people went on with their lives. And maybe you didn't. Maybe you did. But from that day,
blanked out there. I missed a phrase or two.
Well, I was just that life did go on, but from that day to this, it's no big deal to hear somebody upon the mention of Nixon's name. Yeah, his only crime was that he got caught. You ever heard that said?
Yeah, I've heard it said, but not for a long while.
God, I heard it said not 2 weeks ago.
Do you remember by whom?
Just idle conversation. I mean, I talk with strangers. You know, my mother's warning never got through.
By the way, when I say that the country moved on in the wake of Watergate, that doesn't mean that we forgot all about it. As a matter of fact, I seem to recall the House, the elections in 74, the midterms of 74, something like 49 Republicans lost their House seat because many of them were too slow to jump off the support Nixon train. So I remember that. So that's something that constituted part of moving on or moving forward. And as I recall, there were some laws enacted involving reforms and redefinitions of what was appropriate in terms of campaign spending and contributions. So that would come under the moving forward category. Of course, a lot of that has gone by the wayside. But I'm just that's what I mean. I guess I meant moving on, but also moving forward and learning from the sad experience, at least temporarily. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, my only point being that there's a segment of this country that's okay with whatever generally speaking, if he's your guy, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And for all I know, I may be guilty of it because back when the whole Clinton thing was going down, I didn't see that as an impeachable offense. I saw that as being some really slimy behavior and something that needed to be worked out by Mr. and Mrs. Clinton in privacy. And if it wound up in a divorce and him having to pay her everything that he made for the next 40 years, so be it.
And it certainly didn't justify impeachment proceedings or Ken Starr's, what is it, $47 million?
70.
Was it 70? Jesus, help us. Boy, that was money pissed away for a partisan purpose, or for no good purpose even. Jesus.
Yeah, maybe I was guilty of my own partisanship. But I like to think that if there was a Democratic president who was doing what Trump is doing, that I would be as vociferous against that conduct as well. But then again, what's the likelihood that that we'd ever nominate a Trump? I mean, we didn't even have anything resembling a Trump running this time through.
Okay,
we had a brilliant, capable woman and a highly intelligent senator from Vermont.
Yeah. Well,
a Trump can only happen on the Republican side, because the Republican side, as he himself noted,
if I ever ran for president, I'd run as a Republican because they're all idiots.
Yeah. Have you ever heard any Republicans or conservatives comment on that?
Oh, no. Nor have I heard any of them asked.
Yeah. Well, they ought to be.
Well, it's like something. I'm sick and tired of this godforsaken national anthem debate. And I suggested earlier today on Twitter that there's one way to put this one to bed once and for all. Have one, with no warning. And I don't think we're giving anything away by me mentioning it on our little program here. I don't think we're being monitored by the White House.
Mm-hmm.
If we are, fuck all of y'all. But there's one way to put this to bed once and for all. And that is to have a reporter, without any warning to Trump, say, okay, you're so concerned about the national anthem, repeat the first verse. You don't have to sing, Donald. Just say it.
Yeah, and it'll get tricky at the end.
And then when he can't, just say, then shut up about it, because you don't care about it worth a damn yourself. You're just demagoguing it. Fuck off.
Well, he would get some version about every third word of the first verse, or something that rhymes with it or sounds like it. Or
Jose, can you see? I knew Jose. Jose worked for me one time.
I'll bet you dollars to donuts that he thinks the last two words of the first verse are play ball. Okay, so, you jot that down and
Dawn Shirley Hot. I knew Dawn. I fucked her. She was like not a 10, but she was probably like an 8.2. Dawn was. She was Shirley Hot.
Yeah, yeah. I mean that's Trump's. Yeah, if they ever asked him, he would.
What so proudly we yelled.
Jeez, I.
When in twilight, my pants were creaming.
No. I told you we got to keep this on a higher level today. There's been enough nastiness emanating from the Senate today. The Republicans.
Oh, come on! I mean, you didn't even suggest a cowbell for, because Dawn Shirley so hot.
Well, yeah. The cowbell for you, Bob, is always implied.
Oh, that's a cheap out.
No, I but okay, listen. It wasn't 1 or 2 minutes, but I'm going to try to keep this short. But I do want to touch back on the absence of Al Franken, because you're not alone. I thought of him, in the run up to today's proceedings. Thinking, well, I'll bet you if Al was here. And I'll tell you what inspired it. There was a thing, I forget where I got it from, but I posted it on the Horn Facebook. Very quickly find it so I can copy it and send you the link in case you haven't seen it. Bear with me. This will take a moment. By the way, what do you think about the crazies burning merchandise they bought from Nike?
Well, when you're a maggot and you don't have a cross handy to bear, you can always just burn your Nikes.
Yeah.
I'm a cross handy to burn, not bear.
Well, now I can't find it. Shit. Well, basically what it was is one of the online publications talked to a bunch of different activists from a bunch of different places posing the question, what should the senators ask Mr. Kavanaugh? And there was a litany of good ideas from a wide variety of thinkers and knowers and historians and activists. And I will search that out and send you the link, because it could make for some, you know, another form of Supreme Court nominee bingo. In other words, this time you would mark questions that were not asked. I guess you couldn't even do that, because there'd be nothing but blank spaces on the bingo card. But somebody needs to send this to all of our senators on the Judiciary Committee, a link to this article, and I'll send it to you, and then you can send it to others to maybe do that, because there were some none of them I can remember, but there were some damn fine queries that they hoped the senators would ask, at least on our side.
Okay, I'll look for it.
Okay, but anyway, I'm going to tough through it for however many days this thing goes this week, because it's important enough, and I've written to both of my senators, both Feinstein and Ms. Harris, but I am definitely looking at calling instead of emailing, because it'll be a little easier, all of the Republican members on Judiciary and registering with their office, each one's office, my voice, my opinion, that they need to stop what they're doing and just not confirm this guy. And you can do that. I know sometimes the senators who are not from your state don't like to hear from people who don't reside within their borders. But in the case of the Senate Judiciary members, I think if I let them know that I'm contacting them on the, you know, by virtue of the fact that they're on that committee, that gives me some sense of a right to be there, because, you know, they're a vital part of the process that will, may or may not, probably will have an impact on me.
Right, and that business of, well, you're not from my district, that's kind of disingenuous anyway, because the fact of the matter is, the people of Nebraska do not sign Ben Sasse's check.
The people
of the United States do.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, I'll send you that link as soon as I can find it. I know I saved it. I just can't lay my hands on it right now. But anyway, this will be a short call. But I appreciate your presence on the broadband or the airwaves or however it comes to me, because you know, somebody needs to point these things out, and you and the other and the people listening, you got the brightest audience going. I mean,
oh, no kidding.
There was something that somebody said the other day, and I laughed at it, first of all, but even on my best day, or a thousand years of best days, that was a take on it, whatever it was, that I just would never, it would never have occurred to me. And the listeners are constantly doing that, you know?
Oh, it makes what I do a privilege and a pleasure.
Yeah. And to listen to. And I try to turn people onto the show and always tell them to give you a try, or give you a fair hearing, because it's a hell of a show. It really is. And to let you know that I sent them if they stick around, you know, and I don't know if any have done that. But I try to post on Facebook the link to listen live or to check out the archives. As a matter of fact, there's a woman down in Australia who apparently I knew when she went to school in Alexandria when I was in high school, but I don't remember her. But we've reconnected via Facebook, and I don't know what the time difference works out, what time of the day or night this show is on live, but I just can't seem to get her to check out the show. Oh, I know what the last thing is, and then I'll go. 2 months or 2 days from now is something, well, on two levels. 2 months and 2 days from now is a very important date. Now, it works out that it's November 6th, if I've figured my numbers correctly. Not only is it the midterm election day, but November 6th would mark the 117th anniversary of the birth of my paternal grandmother, Carrie Vensack, who came to this country as a young girl, I think 6 or 7, from Slovakia. And obviously played an important part in the fact that we're having this conversation, okay? Because yeah. She was my dad's mom, okay? But Terry came over to this country not knowing a word of the language, obviously not from being here, and made a go of it, because she was given an opportunity to make a go of it. And yeah, she was, what would that be, Central European?
Yeah, that's Central Europe.
You probably couldn't get much whiter than my grandmother Carrie, although she had sort of a dark complexion for a white woman. But she came to this country, met up with the man who became her husband, who strangely enough was from that region, not too far away, but they never met until they got here. Okay? And when he came over on a different boat at a different time, there was a man on the boat selling little tin cups and spoons for $1 apiece. And you might say, well, what the hell was that about? Well, as the story goes, they tried to sell Pop one of these spoon and tin cup combos because of the stories of America being the land of milk and honey, and you would want to be prepared.
You definitely want to, yes, absolutely.
To scoop up the delicious milk and honey, which was in great abundance in this country. And luckily, he didn't buy one, probably because he didn't have the dollar to do it, to spare, you know. But November 6th is an important day in my lineage and history, because it was the birth date of my grandmother Carrie, and she's living proof that when you give earnest people who are seeking a better way and a better deal, if you give them an opportunity to come through, they will come through. And that's part of what is at stake in 2 months and 2 days for this country, is to get some people elected who value that long-standing American value of welcoming and knowing that part of our greatness is found in our tradition of being open and friendly and willing to lend a hand even to new arrivals, no matter where they come from, no matter what their story is, and no matter how different, supposedly, they may seem to us in their dress, in their language, in their customs. Because the fact that they made the effort to be here should count for something. And, you know, we diminish ourselves when we forget our own history and our own traditions and our own values. So that's what I wanted to close on. And I'm glad I thought of it because, you know, maybe it'll resonate with somebody and maybe they were, you know, just pissed off with the entire process. And maybe they had somebody like a grandmother Carrie.
Well, I think most everybody probably did.
Who came over here, you know, came here from somewhere else, who is responsible in part for their presence. And maybe these memories and this information will reignite some passion that they thought they had lost about participating. Because when we were cleaning out her house after she passed, I came across a trunk and there were old newspapers with historic stories and things. And down near the bottom of the trunk, dated 1922, was a guide to the citizenship test. And on the left-hand page was English, and on the right-hand page was Slovak. And that was the very book that my paternal grandfather used to prepare to become a citizen of this country. You know, these are worthy endeavors when people come here and want to be included. Not only included in our group, but everybody brings something different and unique and wonderful to the party called America. And we can't ever lose sight of that, Bob. We cannot. Because to do so, we do it at the risk of losing something that is foundational in our history and in our culture and in our being. So that's my little 2 cents worth on that. So,
well, and the fact of the matter is, unless you are a member of some indigenous tribe of this country, everybody has some sort of an origin story like what you just described. It's mm-hmm. just that a lot of them want to selectively ignore it or argue that somehow there was some form of manifest destiny at work that made them specially favored by God to come here.
Yeah.
By the way, I have an answer to the time zone question coming from our buddy, the Angry Architect, who is up over Down Under. Okay. Show starts at 9 a.m. on the East Coast, right when we start work. Changes with summertime, but it's always during the work morning. Can't speak for the West Coast, but shouldn't be so different. So there's your Australia question.
Well, I will let my friend know. And, you know, because I think she would enjoy the hell out of this show. Because I'm all the time, you know, sending her stuff or posting stuff, you know, that comes up on the show. And maybe she's checked it and just hasn't bothered to tell me, but I'm going to redouble my efforts because, you know, to miss out on what goes on here is to be much less informed than you ought to be. So anyway, let me let you go there, buddy, and we'll talk again.
Well, I hope your coffee didn't get – well, I hope your freeze-dry didn't get cold.
No, it's fine. I like it at a certain sippable temperature, and it is a little cooler.
Well, I was going to tell you, relative to coffee,
okay,
that if you don't want to go, that there's a really handy, and I took it with me on the trip, because reliable decaf is so damned rare on the road.
Yeah.
The Stanley people, you remember the sort of off greenish lichen green. Vacuum bottle that all the guys carry to their construction sites and whatnot.
Well, now, did they also make the tools like the tape measures?
I don't know. But I do know that they make a little portable French press. Of about, you know, that holds about 16 ounces. That'll make about 16 ounces of French press coffee, and it's got the little plunger in it. And it works surprisingly well.
And that's by Stanley.
Yeah.
All right, I'll look that up, because that...
And the nice thing is, you make your coffee, and it's in that vacuum bottle, and it stays hot for a really, really, really long time. And then you can pour it into your little cup or whatever you want to do, or you can drink it straight out, you know, once you put the plunger down, you can drink it straight out of the jug.
Hmm. Well, that may be right up my alley. I told you I was looking at becoming a pipe smoker again long ago. Well, yeah. I ordered the pipe and some tobaccos, and they should be here in a couple of days. So maybe this would be the thing to do. I'm opening that revisited habit. Maybe it would be nice to have French pressed coffee to go with my pipe.
That could be very nice indeed.
Since
you're drinking real caffeine coffee, you've got all kinds of opportunities there for some really, really good Joe. Whether you like the dark roast, medium roast, a light roast, whether you like the coffee beans that Malloy offers for sale on his program with the Mexican Marigohipe beans that are so mm-hmm. awesome. I mean, decaf, it gets really limited, but for why not enjoy the coffee?
I can't remember the coffee that I used to drink back when I was my first marriage. She was a stickler about this thing. We had to buy beans, and we had to grind them in the little grinder thing. And I think we used a Melita coffee maker with the cone thing.
Yeah.
And I wish to God I could remember the name of the blend or whatever of the coffee, because it was medium, but it was on the strong end of medium. And you could never make a bad cup of coffee with that. And if we were still on speaking terms, I would call and ask her what it is. Well, I know one of my nieces talks to her. Maybe I'll find out through her. Well, but right now we communicate through rumor and innuendo. But to close for good this time, what I would like to find, you talk about coffee makers, and we haven't talked about Breaking Bad for a while, but the one that the guy that Walter White had down in the lab with him when he was... when Jesse was sluggish and out of sorts and upset, I can't think of his name, but the rather portly fellow with the light hair, he had a coffee maker to end all coffee makers, built on scientific principles.
Well, by the way, the other thing I ran across as we attempt to wrap this call up.
Yes, I hate long goodbyes too. Yeah. But go ahead.
But I was in one of our Rippy Marts has a Dunkin' Donuts in it.
Yeah.
And I don't get all tingly about Dunkin' Donuts coffee, but they had marked down a cold brew coffee maker, and it's just a Lucite cylinder with a metal lid and a little screw on filter, but they'd marked it down to like $3.
Oh wow.
And if you use a really, really good dark roast, I made myself, and I made regular for the boss, but you fill the filter up, you screw it onto the top part, and you thread the top part into the cylinder, and you slowly pour cold water into the top, and it drains down, and you fill, and you put the lid on, and you stick it in the refrigerator for 24 hours, and you get cold brew coffee.
Yeah.
And so I mix that with a little bit of sweetened condensed milk and make Vietnamese iced coffee for the boss. Mm. And it's real tasty.
Hmm.
So
I'm thinking about it. The closest to cold brewed coffee I've ever had, somebody I knew a long time ago in the Midwest had this stuff that they bought, I guess, at the grocery store or something. a jar, like a bottle almost. And you had to refrigerate it once you opened it. But I think you would add it it was like a coffee concentrate. And I'd never had anything like that, but they fixed me a cup, and I said, well, this is pretty good. Is that the same as cold brewed, or?
Cold brew is literally cold water in cold water soaking coffee.
Yeah, but part of the brewing process has to do with the heat, doesn't it? Or
oh my God, don't go down that rabbit hole on the internet. there are people that will call you everything but a human being. Oh, cold brew coffee's not really coffee, man.
Well, I'm not trying to stir anything. I thought. That
but it's a neat little gimmick, and you know, when your coffee's hot, you got to wait a long time for it to get cold, and even if you pour it over ice, you still got the, and it's going to get all watery.
And the only reason I ask about that, not to start anything, but I would think that brewed is not the operative word. The word would be steeped, like you would steep. Tea, but even that.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. It's steeped cold.
Yeah.
Kind of like remember when Lipton introduced the concept of sun tea?
Mm-hmm.
And so you put a bunch of tea bags in a gallon jar and pour cold water on it and set it on the porch?
Yeah, yeah.
And you let the sun brew the tea naturally.
I know I said I was going to go, but now I'm wondering. When you do the cold brew coffee, you slowly pour the water in. How long does it take before it's ready to put in the fridge for 24 hours?
No. It doesn't take very long. A couple of minutes, you know. Because some goes through the coffee grounds, but for the most part, it just goes into the cylinder and sits there and leaches the coffee-ness out of the coffee that is then saturated inside the cylinder.
Hmm.
And it is, sits in the fridge for 24 hours, and out you go.
Now, is the flavor profile, how does that vary from traditionally brewed coffee?
It's cold. Maybe. I think you have to use like a really dark roast, like an espresso roast, because otherwise you've got hot water. It's hot water that releases the essential oils in the coffee that make a great cup of coffee. Oh, dear God, I'm turning.
Well, wait a minute. Now I'm totally confused, and I'm not putting you on. When you sit down to have a cup of cold brewed coffee, you do not drink it hot. Am I understanding this correctly?
Right. Yeah, you don't drink it hot. You drink it cold.
Okay, well, then what I had in the Midwest wasn't, that was a whole different thing. Because I thought it was like a concentrate that you added to a specific amount of boiled water.
No. I mean, it is never hot.
Well, it sounds like my second wife. But anyway, we won't even go down.
Wait a minute.
Down that way.
God, you're always good for at least one, Scott.
Okay. Well, I think on the cowbell, and to get us off this coffee kick, because you're right, it does have. The markings of rabbit holes.
Well, I mean, just next time you're in one of your local Rippy Marts.
What is a Rippy Mart?
You know, a convenience store.
Oh.
Where
okay.
All the prices rip you off.
Oh, okay. All right. I thought there was an actual place out back there, Rippy, you know?
No. Once upon a time, there was a chain called Zippy Mart. And they became known as Rippy Mart because everything was twice as expensive as it was anywhere else.
Yeah.
But anyway, next time you're in your local Rippy Mart, just go back there and get yourself a bottle of cold brew coffee. It's back there in the refrigerator section.
All right. I'll report back and let you know what I thought of it.
Do please. Let's compare it with your standard freeze dried.
Yeah, because every now and again, I like a good cup of iced coffee.
Well, this is like that without the ice. You don't have to fool with the ice.
so it doesn't get watered down.
Yeah.
But right. as Terry in Saigon says, the Vietnamese concept of coffee, paren sludge, close paren, is truly different. And before you do go, I got a note from James in Illinois. Share with Scott. Be aware, it takes a wide mouth jar, and it's a link to something I'm looking now on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll, damn it. damn it. But I'll try to remember after the program, and I'll shoot you the link.
Okay. And this is a something that will delight me.
It's a cold brew coffee thingamajig. I'm waiting for the thingamajig to load. Yeah. Cold brew coffee maker, iced tea infuser, stainless steel filter, mason jar, 1 quart.
Holy fuck! No home should be without one.
Yeah. approximately, it costs approximately $4.59. And makes.
And see, that's the other good thing about this program. Things I have been opened up to me have been a myriad of things that I wouldn't have otherwise known about.
Oh, not the least of which would be your shiny hiney. I'm still waiting for somebody to take one for the team and order one and call in and tell us how fresh and shiny they feel, especially having used the, the bleach-out rubbing compound.
Well didn't Red or Blue Dot in Texas, John, didn't one of his listeners send one to him? Or was it just a T-shirt?
I don't think John, because John wouldn't hold out on us with something like that. He'd tell us about how much his shiny hiney experience. You know, or then again, maybe he wouldn't if he's really our friend.
Yeah. Well,
it got all tingly back there, and ain't no wrinkles on it anymore at all.
I'm gonna start coughing. I better go.
Well, we gotta do this, or else people like Brett Kavanaugh have us running, tearing at our hair in the backyard.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, I'm looking forward to tomorrow's exciting session. All that's missing is Rod Roddy on the old comedy soap, who would give a recap before that night's episode.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Jeez. All right, man, I'll let you go, and y'all take care. You take care, and everybody out there in Radio Land, take care.
All right, we'll see you, Scott. Take care.
Okay, Bob.
Bye. Bye now. The one and only Scott in San Diego. My goodness gracious, our conversations do travel, don't they? Elbert in Rhode Island. Tell Scott to check out on eBay. He'll find the coffee pot like the one he remembers. Okay, yeah, a percolator pot or a cowboy pot. Flavio says, in western Wisconsin, we have Quick Trip, which is a convenience store chain. The locals call it Quick Rip. The only drawback of the French press, as opposed to paper filters, is that you also get the coffee oils, not so good for the cholesterol. I had no idea. But then again, I have a couple of cups in the... Okay, so it's a little ritual. I'm usually up about 6 or a little after. I wake up, rub my eyes, turn on my filthy little habit, like I did this morning, and lo and behold, Joe and Mika were on the program together, but they still won't sit next to each other on the news desk. They're probably both in New York, or one's in New York and one's in D.C., but they do not apparently want to sit together. And they announced a remote from, I think, Oxpatch, Mississippi, next month or a couple of weeks from now or whatever, where they will probably have to sit together. So it may be kind of interesting. By the way, that cold brew coffee thingy that James turned us on to, the bad news, it ships from China, and it might take 46 weeks to get there, 4 to 6 weeks to get there. Again, thank you to Renee in D.C.,
and to Charlene and to Steve in New York for helping out this evening. We have taken the fundraising goal down from 300 to 245. It would be nice if we could wipe out the last 45 bucks so that we'll at least have Monday finished. And again, thanks to our buddy Laborman and our buddy Ralphs and our anonymous friend for putting forward Shirley's challenge at the beginning of every month. Let's see, Bill in Allentown. It's probably 8 o'clock coffee from A&P. I think Wally World sells A&P now.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so back to the white power sign and that weird little bit of business. And as is often the case, Michael and Madison and I are on the same page. And only I didn't make it as clear as he did. Subject line, the OK sign. I recently had this discussion with a friend who was asking about the OK sign. And as much as I hate to disagree with the Anti-Defamation League, they got it 100% wrong on this one, saying that it's not a hate sign. The only way it's not a hate sign in current right-wing American culture is if you buy into the alt-right's own bullshit. The weirdos on 4chan and Reddit and the other online cesspools always claim that everything they do is just a prank to own the libs. You know, kind of like the way they're out there burning their Nike tennis shoes and cutting the swoosh off their Nike socks to own the libs. One of these days, we're going to have a long talk with them people. Remember how they pranked the media into thinking that the Parkland shooter was a very specific flavor of white supremacist because he was one, just maybe not that specific flavor? Yeah, like that. Sowing confusion is their game. But the OK sign was used as white power symbols as a white power symbol before they tried to claim it was a prank against the media, and it has been used even more often by assholes with openly fascist, racist views since then. I shared a Lifehacker article with my friend because this one gets it correct, in my opinion, and the ADL would do well to take notes. From Lifehacker.com, is this an innocent OK sign or a white power symbol? The quote from the article that best summarized the piece is this. But whether or not the OK sign ever actually meant I'm a white supremacist in the hands of a Trump supporter, it now means I'm OK with you thinking I'm a white supremacist for the sake of a joke. That's a bad look. It's pretty hard to insist you're not racist when you're trying to trick people into thinking you're racist. Bingo, says Michael. The only caveat is for those who are not plugged in to alt-right maggotism and are just oblivious to it and think it's still just the good old A-OK sign. The individual you described almost certainly knows the connotations. And to Scott's point, no one ever uses it as a red alert to point out a fascist, racist maggot. I've never seen that, and personally I wouldn't be caught dead flashing that hate symbol in real life. Maybe someday, after all this nonsense is behind us, it can go back to being an innocent A-OK sign. But not today. The only thing that I would add to Michael's analysis is to point out, as I did earlier, there's a difference. When you're giving the A-OK sign, the little finger side, the blade of your hand, is facing forward. When these turds are giving their white power sign, the palm is extended. It's sort of the way that when Winston Churchill was giving the V for victory sign, he always showed it with the back of his hand outward. By the time it becomes the peace sign during the Vietnam protest era, the palm is outward, not inward. See how it works? Because if you're giving the A-OK sign with the blade of your palm facing your viewer, all you're doing is creating a circle with your index finger and your thumb. If you turn the palm outward, then reading left to right, as we do in English, it forms W with the little ring and middle finger, W, and the circle with the index finger and the thumb extending down the arm becomes the P, white power. James in Illinois says, the question in my mind, is it an endorsement or a warning? Well, I think Michael made that clear. Nobody's ever done it as a warning. And there's no way that a former clerk for Sammy Bad Breath Alito is going to sit behind another Republican nominee and give a white power symbol to warn us that this guy's a fucking white supremacist when she actually clerked for one. Let's see. Hung Like Jesus says, hey, isn't showing your palm a sign of defeat? If your hands are completely open. But that's not the case with either the peace sign or the white power symbol. What the little turds over at 4chan did is they inoculated the symbol so that they could go on and use it and then claim, no, it's not about white supremacy or racism. It was a prank. And then the next thing you know, it shows up all over the place. No, they're not really racists. They're making a joke to make you think they're racist. Which, again, as Michael points out, is a pretty shitty thing to do. Well, the program's kind of been eaten alive, I'm afraid, by by Kavanaugh, and the week may be. I mean, it just may be. There's no getting around it. But just to make mention of things, I went over to Nike's Facebook page, and my God, the maggots were losing their minds. And some guy who works for some right-wing radio turd said, my sound man, a former Marine, didn't, and I think you capitalized Marine in that, but not him. It cut the swoosh off of his socks, and I'll never buy Nike again. You know, there's ignorance, and then there's willful ignorance. And this is a pretty profound case of willful ignorance. Because, you know, but it's good to reinforce, this has nothing to do with any level of disrespect toward anybody in the military or of the flag. It has to do with the epidemic problem of young black men being shot by police. Not all cops, but just the same, you get my meaning. So, yeah. Let's see. Silent R. Lamar says, I like the black power sign. It works well in the air or in someone's face. Yeah, the white folk, the white supremacists are going to have a hard time appropriating that, seeing how it's pretty well taken. The things we have to worry about now. Damn. And who knows what's going to be done to with prayer meeting Wednesday tomorrow. Because God knows we've got enough weird to last a lifetime. But let's take a minute, because I don't want Ron DeSantis' monkey comment in Florida to disappear off the radar. So if I can do a little bit to help keep that going concern, then I want to. And it's not just a monkey comment. Remember, after that, the jungle drums and monkey background noises with a fake Andrew Gillum doing a minstrel show voice started going out to phones all over Florida, courtesy of some racist of a racist in Idaho. Enter Jesse Lee Peterson. Well, sometimes we have sound from Jesse Lee. This time it's just a column in Wingnut Daily. And Peterson says that Andrew Gillum is bad news, an American-hating leftist, and said that it was a matter of playing the race card when people said, my God, did he just really use the term monkey to describe the first African-American Democratic nominee for governor of Florida? No, that was the race card, according to Jesse Lee Peterson. Democrats know racism doesn't exist, but they use it to silence white conservatives and to instill fear in blacks and motivate them to vote. Right, because racism doesn't exist, so what is the Klan? Oh, well, they're just a civic pride organization. Mm-hmm. And we're just trying to shut the conservatives up by. That doesn't even make sense. Yep, sounds like, or looks like, since it was written, looks like old Jesse Lee's been into the Maker's Mark stash again. I guess he'll have that. Now, let's see here. A couple of notes coming in just to finish finish out the evening. Cheryl says, let's not forget that Kaepernick checked with war veterans to see what he could do that would not be disrespectful. Exactly. And because originally he was just sitting on the bench during the national anthem, and somebody who was in the NFL who was a veteran said, no, it's better to take a knee. And that's where it came from. But also, let's remember that there was no white pout rage when Jeebus's best friend Little Timmy Jeebo was doing it a couple of years back. Right? Yeah. Exactly. Jimmy pointing out with all my talk about Ben Sasse, the new kind of Republican. Yeah, the new kind of Republican, a Republican wearing white robes and hoods. Some kind of new. Tracy says she's going to go see Black Klansman tomorrow afternoon for $5 Tuesday. She said she'll provide us with a film review subsequent to that. In regard to Jesse Lee Peterson, Alexander, off topic, not really. Fuck that KKQ-ning, Uncle Tomming, step and fetch it, white supremacist of color, Jesse Lee Peterson, a 70-year-old fuckwad. Well, Alexander, don't hide your light under a bushel, buddy. Tell us how you really feel. Thanks, Alexander. And so it's time to get out of here. By the way, James in Illinois says, subject line, darkest hour. Churchill was told that in the working-class neighborhoods, back of the hand meant up your bum. He laughed and said, well, up your bum then, that being directed toward Hitler and the Nazis. I thought there was something to that. Yeah. So thanks to Renee, and thanks to Steve, and thanks to Charlene. I guess tomorrow we'll be at 4:45 to get September started. Thank you to all of you who keep the program going, and thank you to all of you who tune in each evening. And thank you to all of you who listen to the podcast. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you, Sparky, in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.